It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin farmers are being challenged by low milk prices, trade disputes, and the aftermath of wet spring weather. We'll talk to the head of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection about how his agency is responding. First, fake news and other forms of media misinformation are a big concern for many Americans. That's according to the results of a Pew Research Center study released last week. The survey asked respondents about made-up news. It came up as a bigger concern to them than things like terrorism, racism, climate change, or people immigrating to the U.S. illegally. Margot Suska is a professorial lecturer in journalism and mass communication at American University in Washington, D.C. Margot, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this Pew study used the term made-up news. That could cover a lot of ground. What kinds of media misinformation has you worried when it comes to what the public is receiving?
Well, I think that that is something to think about, that this report used the term made-up news and information when it surveyed some 6,200 Americans in February and March. But we, I think, have to consider, what is this definition of fake news? What is it that we're talking about? It means something very specific to me, and it means something very specific to other political science researchers. It might mean something very different than to your uncle sitting at the Thanksgiving table with you when you ask him about what fake news is. But to me, what I'm most concerned with, and I see it align with some respondents in this study, although they didn't ask about fake news, is things like videos being doctored and the sources of information and real questions about things that look like they could be true, but that aren't. And I think that that is something that I'm really concerned with as technology improves. I'm also concerned, I think, with the audience and what they're able to understand as being truthful or not truthful. And I think in this current information and entertainment media ecosystem, it is getting very difficult to identify the sources of information when you have millions of channels at your disposal.
Let's talk about that straight up fake news. I dimly recall that that originally meant people literally making up news stories and making them look like news. They might have been in Macedonia. They might have been in the United States. Is that what you're pointing toward when you say fake news?
Absolutely. And that's, you mentioned Macedonia, and there were investigations by two news organizations that identified 100 sites that were run by teenagers in a small town in Macedonia. Others from outside the U.S. and inside the U.S. have created domain names that look very similar to popular news sites. They may add a .co onto a .com domain name. But these are, yes, complete fiction. And I think one of the headlines that I remember from the run-up to the 2016 presidential election was Hillary Clinton and Yoko Ono having an affair, sometime in the 1970s. It is just complete and utter hogwash. That's what I think of as fake news. But of course, today that term is so politicized that you have the President of the United States, among others, using the term fake news to describe legitimate media organizations like the New York Times and CNN. It's no wonder that Pew avoided the term fake news, because it's really come to mean something, of a very partisan nature.
Right. And if I'm that survey respondent being asked this question about made up news, I could be saying I'm worried about those complete fictional news stories like the one you just mentioned. Or I could be saying, yeah, the New York Times or CNN or whatever mainstream media source, I'm worried that they're making stuff up. Are you worried that that's maybe part of the public perception?
Absolutely. And what we see from the Pew results is that the partisan divide among respondents, what they were worried about and who they blame for the problem of made-up news, it is highly partisan. Republicans are nearly three times as likely as Democrats to say that journalists create a lot of made-up news. And that was 58% of Republicans saying it, compared to 20% of Democrats. And that, to me, is really interesting here about from some of the results. So again, you're absolutely right. What are they talking about when they talk about fake news? And what are these respondents talking about? And in this survey data, we won't know. But clearly, what I think we can take from this survey is that 5 years ago, fake news or made up news, this wasn't even on our radar. By 2017, fake news was named a word of the year, and that now many Americans are putting it above climate change, racism, and immigration as something they are very heavily concerned about.
Margo Suska is with us from American University, looking at a new survey where respondents said they are quite worried about various forms of made-up news, more worried than some other big issues that are out there. Margo, if we spent all our time making up fake news stories and nobody shared them, it probably wouldn't matter so much. What do you make of the fact that people seem to like to pass these things along to other people?
Well, it's true, and I think that is what's so interesting about it, is the viral nature of some of these stories and how many millions of times these fake news stories were shared. And when I say fake news, I mean the complete fictional stories, how many millions of times they were shared before 2016. So I think that there are some really interesting things that come out of this report, however, about not just how we interact with social media and how we interact with mainstream news, but that we are starting to disengage from each other for fear that fake news is going to come into our interpersonal conversations. We are unfollowing and we are unfriending when we see people posting things that look like or that we suspect are fake news. So that was what was really most interesting to me about this Pew Research report, is that not only is it affecting our relationship with news and with politicians and other institutions, but it really is starting to affect our relationship with each other.
What do you see as the role of the mainstream media, however you want to define it, to combat this, to turn the tide on fake and misleading news?
Well, I'll tell you what I would say as the solution is different than what survey respondents said. Survey respondents overwhelmingly believe that journalists have the responsibility to fix the problem of made-up news. Now, again, I know as a researcher and as a former journalist and as someone who trains young journalists here at American University, I know that journalists aren't putting out fake news. I know that. I live that. So when I think that, you know, when I hear people say journalists should fix the problem, I think, well, we're already not putting out fake news. So I think that the issue has to be one of education, and it has to be one of media literacy. And what's also interesting is that you've got a dozen states in the United States right now that are looking to write media literacy bills in some way. But I have to wonder, and maybe I'm showing my age here, as a person who grew up with a robust social studies and civics education in middle school and in high school, are we really just talking about a re-engagement with a knowledge of American civic life? The Pew Report, again, says overwhelmingly people think journalists should fix it. They don't put the onus of responsibility on Facebook or on Twitter, where a lot of this information goes viral and is shared. And I was really shocked by that finding from this survey.
Is there a role for journalism to play, though, in debunking? And we have a lot of fact-checking websites out there already. Do you see a role for a subset of journalism in defaking news?
Well, I think I work with full disclosure, with the International Fact Check Network, which evaluates the criteria by which news organizations or fact check arms of news organizations say that they are debunking myths. So I do think, is there a role for news organizations? Yes. But I think that the methodology by which you can go about showing that something is false, I think that that is something that goes beyond what we would consider typical journalism. I also think that we are going to have an issue. If you already think that a certain news organization is biased against your political party or against your viewpoint, and then they have a fact check arm, my guess is, and my hunch is, that you're probably going to think that what they fact check is also baloney as well. So again, I think you're absolutely right. I would love to see more fact checking groups using a robust methodology. But I do think that there is some source issues here that people are going to tend to disagree, or they're going to tend to, see the falsehood, if you will, in the news organization as well as in its fact-checking group as well.
For media literacy and civic education, it seems hard to do because it's such a moving target. In that civics class 20 years ago, what's Facebook? What's the internet in some ways? And now here we are, and maybe 5 or 10 years, there'll be some website we haven't even heard of yet that's the way we get our news.
Sure, you're absolutely right, and it's a really good point. And what I would say is that it isn't so much, you know, targeting Facebook or having a curriculum based on MySpace or something like that, but I do think that it is the foundation of media literacy. When I teach it in the classes I teach here at American, the foundation of media literacy really is critical thinking, and it's looking at sources. And this Pew report showed that more people were looking up the sources that they see in news sources that they see online, or in sources, I don't know if they're all news, but in sources that they saw online. And I thought that was really interesting. But that takes a level of engagement and also a level of leisure time that not everyone, you know, really is going to have. But so I think that critical thinking and understanding sources, I think this is a part of education that doesn't, that you can take with you over the long term, rather than just targeting Twitter or targeting Facebook. And I think the other thing is maybe an understanding of what journalism's role is in society. And I think that my area of expertise is not just journalism, news, and media, but it's the role of corporate media ownership and how increasingly the loss of revenue for news organizations means they're shutting down news organizations. So we've left these news deserts across the United States. And what's happening is, if you don't know a journalist, you don't see a journalist, and you don't know, you know, he or she out on the beat, then you tend to think that you don't have a relationship with journalism. You don't have an understanding of what journalism is supposed to do. And what it's supposed to do is hold leaders accountable. So what you have are leaders who can say, oh, that's fake news. And when you don't know journalists, then, you know, that's the kind of criticism that really can take hold.
We're talking to Margot Suska from American University about people's concerns over fake news and other misleading information in the media and on social media. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a fake or made-up news story? Was it shared with you maybe on social media? Did you recognize it right off the bat? Have you caught yourself sharing something and then later you look back, wait, was that legit? And have you ever called somebody on a story they've shared with you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Margot Suska. She's a journalism and mass communication professor at American University, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about a survey that said, hey, a lot of us are worried about misleading news, made-up news that comes to us in the media, on social media, maybe in particular. Is this a worry for you? Do you have a solution? Do you see this a lot? Maybe on your Facebook feed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Before the internet, I've wondered for decades why high schools don't have, as part of their curriculum, classes to make us better consumers of the news.
Tom, thanks for the call. It seems like there's been a movement, Margot, toward more media literacy. Are we seeing that in more schools?
I can't speak to schools nationwide. I know that American University added media literacy as a core component of a new curriculum overhaul that we did here. I've been teaching for almost 15 years, and it's been a key component of some of the classes that I teach. Of course, I'm a media and culture and journalism professor, so it's a natural fit for me. But I think your caller is absolutely right that we have got to teach young people how to interact and engage with media, and not just news media, but also I think social media as well. It really is dominating their lives. Most Americans on average spend about 12 hours a day with media. We're on the phone, we're watching TV, we've got all sorts of sources, we're listening to the radio in the car, and I think that we really need to be to do better teaching young people about this media environment, because it is ubiquitous.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Margaret, we see surveys saying people get so much of their news from Facebook and a fair amount from Google and other online sources, and we see that those online companies get a lot of the revenue that might have gone to the media in the past. You touched on this briefly earlier, but do you see a role for places like Facebook, for places like Google, in stemming the flow, YouTube too, stemming the flow of fake news?
They have to play a role. Listen, when you're talking about just how powerful these groups are like Google and Facebook with revenue that outpaces some countries in the world, they have got to be able to step in and say, this is how we can help. And if it cuts into their profits a little, I'll be the first one in line to say, so be it. They have got to look at ways that they can stem the tide of fake news. And they certainly, we've learned this week, are profiting off of real news in terms of how they how consumers interact with news online. So in that way, I would say, if you're going to take the good, you've also got to be able to help with the bad. And clearly, viral stories, and Facebook and Twitter play a huge role. They have got to be a part of the solution.
Go back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Wausau. Dave, hi.
Hi. How are you guys doing? Thanks, first time caller. So I was just curious what your analyst's opinion is. When she says that the journalists have no role in combating fake news, so I think there's a difference between absolutely false news. I think in today's day and age, you have nobody actually pays attention to that, right? Nobody actually believes that Hillary Clinton had anything to do with what's-her-face. But we do see a lot of fake journalism. And it's just when she says that journalists have no role, I think there's a lot to be said where that's just absolutely false. There's everybody is so concerned with being first to the market because this 24-hour news cycle, whoever clicks on it first, that's who they're going to read. And so you have these journalists, and she had also mentioned that people are fact-checking a lot more and how they're checking the source's source, which is absolutely necessary. But I think the journalists don't do that. I think this whole, ever since probably 2014, 2016, everybody's just, if Washington Post says something, they'll cite Washington Post, but they don't actually look into whether or not the Washington Post article is actually accurate. And so you get a lot of these little inaccuracies. And then
gotcha, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call. Margot, I don't think you said journalists have no role, but what do you think about what Dave said, the rush to be first in something and then not checking the other sources and confirming the other sources?
Yeah, so I teach journalism ethics here, and what I tell my students is I want them to be right rather than to be first. And again, I think this is part of the issue where we have too many things that we're trying to address. And I would question the caller saying that things on that the Washington Post reports are not truthful or that they would fall under the category ever of fake news. I mean, the Washington Post is one of the most esteemed and should be one of the most trusted news organizations in the country. Does it get things wrong? Yes. Does it have an ethics policy, a corrections policy that follows journalism guidelines? Guidelines? Yes, and it does. But again, when you have to run a correction because you are rushed or because you don't for whatever reason there was an editing error, that is not what I would consider fake news. And I think that that's something that, you know, you really have to look at. And again, when I say journalists don't have a role, I would say, again, that's why I would say the Washington Post doesn't have a role because it's not producing fake news. Could it do better, objectively looking at different information that comes from different politicians or when it's on the campaign trail? Certainly, yes, I would say, but I don't think that's an issue as it relates to fake news.
Thanks for making that first call, Dave, at 800-642-1234. Margot Suska is with us from American University talking about fake and or misleading news. On that issue of the speed of news, Margot, sometimes we see after a tragic event, a shooting, the journalists are trying to get things right, give details as they come in. And there you see fake news sources or conspiracy-oriented news sources not at all reluctant to jump in and get their take out on the story first. How disruptive do you see that being?
I think that it is disruptive, and I think this is where I have been lucky enough to attend a conference on trauma journalism at the University of Missouri where I've studied this issue. I've done some research on coverage, objective coverage of mass shootings in the last 5 years. So I think that this is where I would say to people, turn to your local sources. It is unfortunate that we, in our fresh memory, the shooting in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and rather than just following a hashtag on Twitter, I went right to two reputable newspapers that I know in Virginia, and I was following their coverage online. So rather than just looking for a hashtag or just looking for a social media site, find out. If something happens in Milwaukee, then you know, look to the Milwaukee Journal. Don't just follow a hashtag. This is where going directly to the source and to a local source is going to matter, likely because they're going to know better law enforcement sources in the case of a tragedy or of trauma reporting. But yes, do journalists try to fill the void sometimes? Do they get things wrong trying to be too fast and try to get information out when we know people want to click on it? The answer is yes, and journalists can do better in that regard.
Time for one more call. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hello. I just have a question for your analyst in terms of what we choose to spotlight on the news and if there's any relationship to that being fake news. For example, a very small story could be shown multiple times, thus it's creating it bigger than what it really is. I'll take my answer offline.
Interesting, John. Perspective, context, and how much a story is repeated and blown out of proportion, maybe. Margo, what do you think?
Well, I think that there is research to suggest that if a story has images, that it will be run more. And that's why, you know, when you turn on the evening news tonight when you get home, you're not going to see a lot of footage from inside Congress unless it's somebody yelling at somebody else. And that's because, let's face it, it's very important news, that's very important information there, but a little bit boring in terms of the television visuals. So, yes, if you see a perp walk, what we call somebody being arrested and being taken across a stage, or across a law enforcement line, for example, this helicopter crash tragedy in Manhattan, you see smoke pouring from a building, that's going to be shown nonstop on CNN. If it tends to have images, we will see it more. So that's why radio, I have to say, is one of my main sources of news, because you don't have that clutter and you don't have that expectation that's going to come the visual with the news story.
I do hold pictures up to the microphone, but it doesn't seem to make a difference. Margo, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Margo Suska is a professor of journalism and mass communication at American University in Washington, D.C. She joined us to take a look at new surveys showing a lot of Americans are worried about misleading news coming to them on social media and elsewhere. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the head of Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, looking at some of the challenges facing Wisconsin's farmers. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, according to a new report, the cost of emergency room visits jumped 176% between 2008 and 2017. We'll learn what played a role in that price jump in just a bit. First, it's been a challenging year so far for Wisconsin's farmers. A wet spring delayed crop planting on many farms, and disputes between the U.S. and its trading partners have caused uncertainty about where agricultural goods will get sold. That's all adding to the problem of already low milk prices, something that's accelerated the rate of farm closures around Wisconsin for the last several years. Brad Paff is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Secretary designee Paff, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with our weather in Wisconsin and how it's affecting our farms. A very wet spring delaying planting. Can you talk about what you're seeing out there and what kind of impact it's having on our farmers?
Well, without a doubt, Mother Nature is always the last one in order to make the determination on what's going to happen. We had a very cold and snowy winter, and this spring has been quite wet. Wisconsin farmers are very hardworking and very resilient, and they are getting their crop in the ground, but it has taken some time. But for the most part in the state of Wisconsin, at least in the southern part of the state, we do have our corn and our soybeans planted, and we're beginning first cut hay. but it has led to some challenging and stressful nights for our farmers.
I understand that there was a risk of being too late for full levels of insurance coverage, of crop insurance coverage. Did most of the farmers, did most of the crops get in under the wire for that?
For the most part, they did. However, again, there was a lot of stress and there was a lot of back and forth conversations that family farmers had with their neighbors as well as their crop consultants and their crop insurance agents to make sure that they can continue to have risk protection on the crop that they put in the ground.
Now, your agency recently warned farmers about accepting illegitimate loans as they look for financing to cover their spring operations. What kind of things are out there that they should be worried about?
Well, without a doubt, the market price for farm goods isn't at the level that we'd like it to see. In fact, over the last 4 years, farmers have experienced some pretty low prices when it comes to dairy as well as corn and soybeans and other crop commodities. As a result of that, it's never easy in order to make ends meet, but there are some farmers that were looking in order to make sure that they had lending to put their crop in the ground. And a number of different various lending institutions decided or sought the opportunity to come into Wisconsin and provide that a different form of lending. And we at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, our Farm Center, as well as working with the Department of Financial Institutions, we've been hearing various stories from accredited agriculture lenders as well as farmers themselves saying, hey, you may want to take a look at this. We've been contacted by a firm or firms from out of state that are offering us lending opportunities that may be too good to be true.
Can farmers reach out to the state if they're getting those too good to be true offers and they want to make sure it's legit or find out if it's not?
Oh, I strongly encourage them to reach out to our Farm Center here at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We seek that information. We want to learn more if there are lending institutions or individuals that are acting as lenders claiming that they have low-interest loans available for growers.
You mentioned low commodity prices. I wanted to follow up on that. Very low prices of milk, in particular, a big challenge for dairy farmers in the state. Farmers don't have control over the price of their product. Neither does the state. But are there things your department and the state are trying to do to help out?
Well, you are correct. Farmers, for the most part, are price takers and not price setters. Now, we do work hard in order to provide opportunities. As farmers, they work hard to provide opportunities in order to set their own price. For instance, joining cooperatives or trying to sell directly to a local marketplace, may it be through a farmer's market or some type of community-supported agriculture. But for the most part, for the vast majority of our agriculture producers, they are selling into a larger marketplace and they cannot set that price. But what can we do? What are opportunities? Well, there are opportunities in order to do more to sell our products locally, regionally, statewide, nationally, and internationally. Wisconsin last year, in July of 2018, former Governor Walker, working with System President Ray Cross from the University of Wisconsin System, established the Dairy Task Force 2.0. We had 31 individuals from around the state that volunteered and stepped forward and spent an awful lot of time, and they came up with 51 different recommendations of what we can do as a state in order to try and capture more of the consumer market share when it comes to dairy, but also what we can do in order to try and provide more avenues of profitability for our family farmers. Agriculture in this state contributes $88 billion annually to our state's economy. It is one of the top economic drivers of our state's overall economic health. One out of every 9 people in this state that have a job that is related to agriculture. Making sure that we connect the dots between our consumers and our family farmers is extremely important. And that needs to be done in all 72 counties. Agriculture is not just a rural economic driver. It is an urban economic driver as well. southeastern Wisconsin is a strong economic agriculture sector. When you look at the heavy manufacturing of equipment that's taking place, as well as the food processing that's taking place in the southeast Wisconsin. So all Wisconsinites, all 5.7 million people that live in this state and all 72 counties are impacted by what's happening on our family farms.
Talking to Brad Paff, head of the state's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We've talked a lot about agriculture, a little bit of consumer protection there. Let's get into the third part now, trade. A lot of concern about the impact of tariffs on Wisconsin exporters. That includes agriculture. It also includes manufacturers. What are you seeing happen in Wisconsin right now?
Wherever I travel, people talk to me about what's happening with these international markets. We in Wisconsin are blessed. We produce more food than we could possibly consume. We have to find a market for these food products. May that be a local market, regional, statewide, national, or international. International exports continue to grow in our state. In fact, last year alone, we exported over $800 million in agriculture and food products to 147 countries. That's what we did in 2019, our first quarter of 2019. So the first 3 months of this year, we exported $800 million of agriculture and food products to 147 countries. Now, the vast majority of that, our top three export markets are Canada, China, and Mexico. They make up well over 50% of the exports that we are selling. So anything that's going to impact those three markets has an impact on the family farm, it has an impact on our rural communities, and it has an impact on our urban community. All people in the state of Wisconsin are impacted by this.
What are you looking forward to now that this back and forth with China is still going on? The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is still unratified by the three countries. What big question marks are on the horizon for you when it comes to exports?
Well, I think we need to recognize the fact that our farmers seek certainty. Our farmers seek stability. Our farmers understand the fact that, you know, it's very costly to participate in agriculture. Mother Nature may not always participate or assist at times. It may rain too much or it may not get enough rain. But they're willing to step forward every single day and do their very best work, our farmers are. And what they seek is they seek someone that will continue to promote their product. They want people to be able to tell the story of agriculture and to promote the products that come from our family farms, but they seek certainty in markets. They've worked hard to develop these markets. May these markets be in Canada, may these markets be in China, or may they be in Mexico. And I think we need to recognize the fact that we can't just turn these markets on and turn these markets off. We need to make sure that we are reliable suppliers to consumers from around the world, because we cannot eat and consume all of the food products that come from our farm fields or from our dairy farms. So I have been doing everything I can to make sure that we here in the state of Wisconsin, I communicate with our family farmers to know that I will do what I can to make sure that markets are available to sell our products. I am happy that the governor's 2019-2021 biennial budget recognized the importance of local, regional, national, and international markets, and he's put funding forward to be able to move our products. He recognizes the importance of that. Our farmers recognize the importance of this, and they recognize the fact that anything that we do in the short term is going to have could have long-term impacts with our trading partners.
Secretary Paff, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. I greatly appreciate it.
Brad Paff is the Secretary Designee of the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He was with us to talk about the challenges Wisconsin farmers are facing after a wet spring, international tariffs, and low milk prices. Coming up, the cost of a visit to the emergency room has increased a bunch, according to a recent report. We'll find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers and Wisconsin's First Lady Kathy Evers will be with us to talk about the 100th anniversary of Wisconsin's ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave many women the right to vote. First, a new report found that the cost of emergency room visits increased by roughly 176% by 2017. That's according to analysis from the nonprofit Healthcare Cost Institute, which looked at insurance claims between 2008 and 2017. One possible cause could be changes to medical billing codes that allow doctors and hospitals to conduct higher cost tests and procedures. Our next guest is here to talk about these changes and other issues that could be contributing to an increase in the cost of ER care. Dr. Patrick Remington is professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, thanks for being with us again today.
Good to be with you.
Well, let's take a look at what this group did. They took some of these numbers of the costs of emergency room visits. Looking at their information that they shared, what do you see in these numbers?
Well, this group is presenting at a national conference, and they looked at a decade of costs of emergency room admissions. That's not the total cost of care. Obviously, if you go to the emergency room, you may lead to very expensive follow-up costs in a hospital. and they found that over the last 10 years that the cost increased 176%. Now, that's actually a 2.76 times higher. And that went up to about $1,400 in 2017. But again, you have to think about that as being over an entire 10-year period. So I did a little sort of back of the envelope calculation, and that's a 12% per year increase every year for the past 10 years. And obviously, with that increase in cost, those prices have to come from somewhere. People are paying more for health care, so it means that employers are going to be contributing more, or employees are going to be contributing more to their health care insurance premiums.
I want to dig into some of the possible causes. One thing I thought, okay, maybe this is a good news story. Now the people who are going to the ER for more daily care, a normal office visit, maybe they're getting that treatment in different settings, and now the people who are still going to the ER are more likely to have a serious medical concern that's inherently more expensive. Is that one possible read, or am I way off there?
No, you're right on. I think that's maybe the optimist view, that this is simply that we've done a good job over the last 10 years in moving primary care and sort of routine visits away from the emergency department and into primary care settings where they'd be treated much more effectively and at a much lower cost. So that may be partly, but the researchers looked at two things. They looked at the prices, and so prices have gone up. So that would suggest that it's not just leading to more complex care with less complicated care going to outpatient settings. The other evidence is that this increase of about 12% per year is about what we've seen in general medical care, expenses of medical care. Some periods over the last few years, particularly as the Affordable Care Act rolled out, we saw lower rates of increase for health care. So the 12% per year is at the higher end. But these are just general trends in medical care in general, that costs are increasing faster than wages and cost of living.
What is driving those general increased costs in healthcare?
Well, one issue is that patients are basically insulated from these costs. We'd like to think that healthcare can work as a market where people are aware of the price of a product and the quality, like going to a restaurant. You know how much your meal is going to cost. It usually says it on the menu. And you also, certainly by the end of the meal, have a sense of the quality of the food. That's just not present in healthcare today, certainly not in an emergency department, where you wouldn't go into the emergency department and see a list of the cost of all the services and you have really no way of telling the quality. So we are not in a market-based approach in emergency medicine. We require Other systems to control costs, and those obviously aren't working.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at a report, a presentation from the Healthcare Cost Institute, finding the costs of emergency room visits going up a lot over the past decade. Patrick, another thing they did in this report was break it down by five different admission codes, as I understand it, from least to most serious. And it looks like, as they report it, the ones that were at the most severe emergency levels, those are the ones where we saw the biggest increases in costs. That's really apparently what's driving the overall increase of costs. What did you see there?
Well, again, I think this is a general tendency we've seen in healthcare, is that as time goes on, healthcare gets more complex. Technology is a great device, or it's great to have technological advances so that we can have higher quality care, but those technological advances come at a cost. And so what you hope is that the value of the care that you're getting is still very good, that although the cost may be increasing, that it's a higher quality of care, that outcomes, patient outcomes in the emergency department are better. So in effect, it's a good investment. But this study and others, it's really hard to know what the quality of the care is, because we don't have studies like we do on the cost, on the quality of the outcomes. So it's really hard to say. We see costs going up. We hope that the quality is going up right along with it, so you're getting at least the same value of your healthcare dollar.
Is there a concern that maybe this higher technology stuff is being used in ERs even when it isn't strictly necessary? Or is it, hey, we've got this technology, we've got this patient here, we'd be remiss if we didn't use it?
Well, I think it's probably some of both. I think the authors of the study did propose that there could be some profit-making, that one person's cost is another person's profit. And we certainly know in for-profit or even non-profit settings is that if you're on the inside, that represents revenue. And so this is this dynamic tension between people who are paying the bills, whether it's the patients, insurance companies, or employers, and the people who are providing care and collecting that revenue. And so hospitals and health systems and emergency departments need to collect revenue, and that's a careful balance between how much is the right cost of care and how much is perhaps generating too much profit on the cost side.
A lot of the big debates in healthcare policy over the last bunch of years, Patrick, has been who pays under the Affordable Care Act or single payer people are calling for. Have you seen as much attention on what's driving the healthcare costs themselves and what we can do to hopefully bring those down while not endangering people's health?
Well, the problem with healthcare, as I mentioned earlier, is that it really is a hard commodity to be in a true marketplace. That when people are sick, particularly needing emergency care, it's not a time when you want to price shop. So we know that the market is a challenging approach to take with healthcare. But we also know that other countries around the world that have single payer systems, where they control supply and they really can dictate the price that will be paid for a product, they've had better luck in controlling the increase in costs. Not that costs aren't going up around the world, but our rate of inflation, of medical care inflation, is two or three times higher than the rest of the world. We pay at least twice as much per person in the U.S. for health care. And that's most people think that's a result of the fact that we don't have a single payer system. We have less control on the payer side, and we rely on the marketplace to control costs. And it doesn't work as well as having a control on the payer side like a single payer system would.
When we talk about emergency rooms in our last minute, just bringing this back to that, do you see a lot of attention paid to the costs of ER care? Maybe especially for people who need it the most and can afford it the least?
Well, I think this is it is not the best place to think about cost of care, because these are patients who absolutely need the care. So I think some of the cost cutting that has been done has been in hospitals, in looking at shortening stays and improving discharge and reducing the likelihood of patients coming back, and also at managing chronic illness in an outpatient setting. So I think this reason this study got some attention is that people really haven't been paying attention to the costs in the emergency department at a time when, again, you're focused on getting people's serious illness taken care of and less focused on the cost. But it obviously folds into the entire challenge in the U.S. healthcare system, which is costs that are rising higher than wages, higher than cost of living, and that trend is absolutely unsustainable.
We'll leave it there. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Joined us today to look at a new report on the costs of emergency room visits. Tomorrow on Central Time, we're going to talk about music and how we collect it. Apple is ending iTunes, apparently. That has a lot of people worried about the future of their digital music collections. It sounds like there's going to be a way to keep your stuff, so don't panic if all your music is on iTunes. We're going to ask you, too, how do you collect music? Do you have lots of vinyl taking up space at home, lots of CDs? Do you have a lot of things on some digital storage mechanism, maybe through iTunes? Or do you just stream it now? Call in and tell us your music story at 833-42-IDEAS. You can leave a message there in number form. That's 833-424-3327, 833-424-3327. I've got a hodgepodge. I gave up on vinyl years ago. Finally put out the cassette in a garage sale a few years back. 50 cents a piece. It was quite a bargain. I'm sorry you missed it. Now I've got a CD collection that ends, about 8 years ago, and there's nothing newer in there since then. I have some digital music. I stream. It's a mix. How about you? How do you have your music? 833-424-3327. Leave us a message. We'll talk about it more tomorrow. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is sounding confident that the deal with Mexico to stem the flow of migrants will make a difference, and soon. He spoke at the State Department today as NPR.